To be different, to hold to your ideas, to voice them, especially when it matters, it takes courage. Our next guest, Nicholas Chalon. He just resigned as the Chief Software Officer for the Air Force and Space Force. Nicholas resigned because he felt that he could do more good on the outside. He drove an enormous amount of changes within the Air Force and within DOD. But he'll tell you that he was starting to get a little bit stale, that he was starting to lose that innovative edge. So he decided to go on the outside, but his commitment to the fight still remains. But he has the courage to dissect the problems that the Air Force and the DOD is facing in software development, artificial intelligence, cyber, and he talks candidly that China is ahead of us. And if we don't get with it within the next year, we won't catch up. We talk about the problems, but Nicholas goes into great detail about the specific solutions of what we need to do as a country and what we need to do now to be ready on AI, to be ready on cyber, and all of the software development practices that that will require.
And this was a meeting on adopting Agile. And I remember all these people talking about Agile, but I could tell very quickly that they knew the buzzwords, but they had no clue what they were talking about. They actually had never probably used Agile in any projects in their entire lives. They were trying to do the right thing, and they're good people, right? But they just don't know any better. And you had all these people talking, and I asked what I thought was a fair question. I didn't create a lot of friends that day, but I said, but who here has even use Agile in an actual project before? Right, and so I raised my hand, and I think one person out of 50 or 60 raised their hands, right? Yeah. And they were the group that was supposed to bring the answers as to how to implement Agile in DoD. That was just mind-boggling to me. I was like, this is a joke. Why am I here? Why am I wasting my time?
GovCon Different. Ideas from the outside applied to GovCon to drive change.
Nicholas, really appreciate you coming on the show today. Great to talk with you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you said in the press recently that we have no competing fighting chance against China in the next 15 to 20 years. Now, that's a bold statement. Why is that in your view? Can you make the case and help people understand why you believe that we really don't have a competing chance against them in the next 15 to 20 years?
Yeah, and of course, there was a little caveat to that, which is if we don't wake up right now, and we're running out of time. But I guess the critical aspect of that is because not only are we competing against 1.5 billion people, which compounds the problem, but the bureaucracy, the silos, and egos are getting in the way of progress in the government. And so slowly but surely, we're getting behind. We see China, you know, leading, I would argue, in cybersecurity and AI ML adoption, moving at a much faster pace, taking it seriously, both in terms of education, but also in terms of training of their workforce. And of course, they have the luxury of mandating their companies to work with the Chinese government. We don't want to get there, and we don't want to lose our values, but we also don't want to wake up in 15 years and realize we have to learn Chinese.
Yeah, absolutely. With that said, you mentioned AI and we're behind. What are some specific examples, Nicholas, that you see out there that people really need to know so that they can understand this fully?
Well, I think, you know, it's very true that the US companies are doing very well in AI, right? But I think what people fail to realize is that the US government has mostly no access to it, or very small anecdotal pockets of access to the commercial technologies in AI. And so effectively, we're, you know, as a government, as a war-fighting capability, we're getting behind. We see, of course, China investing massively in AI. They touch everything from proactive maintenance to weapons to self-driving and self-flying jets and drones. They use a massive volume of data to do better at training those new models. But also what you also see is that they have the ability to deploy these capabilities faster, at a faster cycle, an accelerated DevSecOps mindset, which effectively makes them more agile and compounds the capability of learning throughout the every day that go by at an accelerated pace. And so when you look back, you know, that ability to deploy to production faster, small incremental improved capabilities, and learn faster and use more data compounds to years of learning, of AI mm-hmm. learning over time. And that's why we argue that, you know, if we don't take action now, and suddenly, you know, according to the RAND study, by December 2022, we will effectively have no chance to catch up.
Wow. I was unaware of the RAND study. I've read, of course, the NSC AI report and others. I did not understand the RAND study.
Are you the only one that read the 750 pages?
I read some of it. I'll be honest. I didn't get through all 800, but we read a lot of it.
I helped write some of it, but I did not read the 750 pages. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when we talk about the amount of data that China has, and they have a lot of end users, and so those models can get better. But what applications do you see that they're doing where we just, it's obvious on the face, they're doing incredible stuff? Is it smart cities? Is it hypersonics? What really sticks out for you?
I mean, it's everything you just mentioned and more, right? They are even smarter than us in terms of how they end up using these capabilities to even get access to US data. You look at TikTok, it is effectively used as an intelligence capability to gather data from the US citizens and then use AI to look at backgrounds and what people say and do and think and their moods and who they know and who they talk to and who is following what, and potentially, of course, a weapon of misinformation as well. And while making tremendous amount of revenue, I believe the valuation right now of TikTok is $450 billion with a B.
Unbelievable.
Which is pretty mind-boggling. And so, you know, they're smarter, right, when it comes to implementations as well. You mentioned that hypersonics. I think it's a great example where the only way to be able to counter and be effective against these weapons will be by leveraging AI ML capabilities for targeting and on the defensive side as well. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that should be one of the waking up calls that our Pentagon leaders should be really paying attention to, because again, we keep calling China a near peer adversary. We're really, they are a peer in many use cases, and mm-hmm. if not sometimes leading where it matters most. You know, people keep dismissing the fact that when we put AI automated flying capabilities on jets and we competed those against the best US pilots every single time, they ended up losing, and the humans ended up losing. And so does it even matter to be focusing on fifth generation fighter aircrafts flown by pilots where really that might not even be relevant anymore?
So why is that when we talk about hypersonics, or if we talk about a pilot in a plane, help, let's say, the person that doesn't work in the fields that we do understand why AI, machine learning, why you can't beat it? What is the advantage? What's going on there, Nicholas, that will leave your existing capabilities just far behind and not able to compete in the fight?
Well, you know, AI is capable of doing things the human brain can't even comprehend. Effectively, it's smarter than us, you know, which is scary. And that's why we suddenly need ethics. But unfortunately, you see, you know, the Joint AI Center not only talk about moving slowly and incrementally, which makes zero sense, but also focus most of their funding on ethics and more reports on why not to build weapon capabilities using AIs when China couldn't care less. And I'm not saying we should forget about ethics, right? It has definitely a place in the conversation, but it cannot be the only conversation we should have. So that's very scary. And so AI is able to come to conclusions that we can't even comprehend. We've seen use cases where it's able to recognize things or come to making decisions that the best experts in the same field can't even begin to understand how that came to be. And it's just, you know, of course, faster, it's more scalable. You can, you know, analyze billions of data points that a human would never be able to keep up with. And it's able to put things together, right, in a way that, of course, no single human would ever be able to do. And so it gives you the scale of information and potentially could save lives. You know, you've seen recently again in Afghanistan where we ended up targeting the wrong target, killing 7 kids. Right. I would argue that if we had better AI capability to track, you know, our imagery on satellites, we could potentially have detected that, you know, hey, there's 7 kids in this car. You're really sure you want to target this just by having a continuous monitoring of targets and things through automation and not humans having to watch feeds in real time.
Now, as you know, there are AI skeptics out there. There are people that say that Tesla autopilots have significant problems, that AI is brittle at this point, and that we're overhyping it a bit. That, for example, if using an autonomous car and coming up to a stop sign, the slightest occlusion could be a few leaves in front of that stop sign, and all of a sudden the AI is confused. So for those that are saying we're overhyping this, we're actually ahead of China, our Navy is better, and we have more F-22s, sophisticated aircraft, what is your counter to that skepticism?
Well, I think it's multifold. First, you know, I think I had a Tesla and I drove to the Pentagon every day, 2 hours each way, and I never had to take over one time, not even a single time. So, you know, thousands of miles. So clearly, I think they need to try a little bit more. And it even got better even more recently with the full self-driving option that I didn't have at the time. So clearly, when also you see the progress made just in few years, right? We're never saying it's perfect, but it's certainly drastically better compared to 5 years ago, let alone imagine what it's going to look like in 5 years. So it's kind of foolish and short-sighted not to look at, okay, but even if it is not perfect today, what is it going to look like in 5 to 10 years from now? So I think 5 to 10 years from now, it's going to be very clear that that's going to be something that can completely replace human driving, period, full stop. When it comes to things, you know, getting in the way of the AI being able to make the right decisions, like, you know, on signs, as you mentioned, the stop sign, you know, talk about also human mistakes. How many accidents are caused by humans drinking or being on their phone and not paying attention? I would argue you're going to see way less accidents of a leaf or a branch blocking a stop sign. Which, by the way, the Tesla is also tracking the markings on the ground. So you would have also to remove the line on the ground of the stop sign. So it's more than just a sign. And by the way, because it's learning the behavior and capturing the maps information as well, it's a multiple kind of piece of information that leads to understand that there's a stop sign, not just the vision capabilities. So I would argue it's able to make faster decisions, take better decisions faster. Where it could get tricky is, you know, you're in a situation where you can't stop, you're going to hit either an old lady and a baby, and you have to pick between the two. You know, as a human, you may be quick enough to decide to hit the old lady, unfortunately, and save the baby. But how many times does that even happen, right? And by the way, because AI is able to leave the right distance and take more proactive action and be safer, I would argue we're going to see way less accidents. Just in terms of drunk driving alone, I think that's going to be a drastic improvement. So I think, and that's just one use case, one example. You see AI improving. I mean, I can tell you with my French accent, when I talk to Siri and Alexa, now they can understand me. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I used not to be able to do that 5 years ago, you know. So it's just a matter of time, and it's just a little bit short-sighted to think that's the end state. You know, it's just the beginning. And the more data you get, the more the larger the fleet, you see Tesla using all that data and that fleet as a continuous learning, and you see the beauty of the same piece of hardware getting over the air update every 2 weeks, and that's just game changing. And I've yet to see us do that in the government, you know.
So you mentioned the government, and I'm always interested in what is the crux of the problem. We hear all kinds of different opinions, and people have companies set up to say, hey, we're the new innovation. Would love to get your thoughts on what is the software problem in DoD?
Unfortunately, it's not a one size fits all answer, but it's actually everything is wrong. You know, when you take a step back, you look at acquisition, you get contracting, you look at Congress and funding, color of money, everything is built to effectively be anti-agile and anti-effective at spending the taxpayer money wisely. We have effectively a built-in tax of doing business that I would estimate at 80%. So meaning from day one, when I estimate work on the commercial side, I would see at least 10 times the cost that I see on the commercial side being the cost that we see on the government side. So that effectively means you have, you know, 10 cents on a dollar spent, but then you compound that to the bubble and the clearance bubble that makes it very difficult for new startups and people to come in and out. So you're stuck in the bubble, and people that leave the government go work for the companies that still provide services to the bubble, and they don't get to see the normal velocity of a SpaceX or a Tesla or a Google or whatever, right? You see the lack of agility, lack of training, even to this date. You know, I helped create the agile training at DoD when agile is 22 years old, and yet it's not mandated. It's not the mandated training. You still have to learn waterfall and all the traditional unvalued management and nonsense that should not even exist anymore. And, you know, 5 year cycle of requirements to build outdated and obsolete capabilities by the time you're done building it. You know, the lack of investment in our people and training and learning is probably the most foundational one, empowering the people at the lowest rank and making sure that we bring to them the best training and biased training so they have options and understand the importance of their decisions, both in terms of architecture decisions, you know, not getting locked into a single cloud provider or a single company, but also all the way to being agile and how does buying capacity of work look like? So you have a capacity of work that you can, you know, prioritize and groom your backlog so you can deliver more value and better value faster. All these things are effectively widely misunderstood. And the worst is you think many people think they know agile and they don't actually know it. Which effectively leads to a lot of water agile fall, which actually compounds all the negative aspects of waterfall and agile into the same outcome. So that's really not the way to go.
Yeah, and it's absolutely heartbreaking when I hear you go through all of those specific examples. But why is it, from your point of view, Nicholas? I mean, why is it so hard to adopt to agile or DevSecOps? Or to fix the clearance process.
There's no benefits, right? There's no urgency, right? There's no, you know, taking risks in the government is often more risk than not taking it. And there's no bonus structure. There's no, you know, even you mentioned, you know, people getting awards. You know, I've seen people getting the best awards that I've just been in a job for a few months. They get the awards because they're just in a job. I've achieved literally nothing yet. And we'll probably achieve nothing, period, full stop. And yet they get, you know, all these fancy awards. That's the entire system is broken, right? There's no tangible outcomes. There's no accountability when people mess up or drop the ball in being proactive in adopting zero trust. Like I pushed zero trust 5 years ago at DHS and I've seen NPPD at the time and the leaders that became the leaders of CISA tell me that they didn't trust zero trust and they want to move to zero trust yet and said no. At adopting zero trust 5 years ahead, and now they're back on the commercial side selling back to the government zero trust capabilities, which is despicable, and they get away with it and still get awards for it. That's the entire system is designed to be like biased and broken, and there's no one held accountable for mistakes, and most of the time, particularly in DoD, we're going to overclassify everything, and even me talking right now is seen as an operational security risk. We're already China is already tracking all this stuff. There is nothing new here. All this does is raising awareness for people that don't want to be held accountable tomorrow if they make the same mistakes and they would rather get away with it.
And I want to dig into a lot of the specifics that you talked about. But before we get to that, if you would kind of take us into an Air Force or Pentagon boardroom, and you don't have to mention names. But what do these meetings look like, Nicholas? I mean, you've got all of this expertise in software, in innovation. I've read through your bio and all of the things that you have invented and innovated. And I've heard you say that, yeah, we talk, but we're not doing the walk, basically. Put us in that boardroom. I mean, what's it like there? What's being said when these senior leaders, when you're talking to them? Because I'd love to just get at what's going on and really get at sort of the root of the problem.
Yeah, I think the most interesting for me when I started is, you know, when you get to the building, you immediately realize that you're disconnected from the rest of the world. I would argue we'll be the last to know if there's an attack on the U.S. soil because we have no phones and no access to common technology. And so you're already in a bubble from the get-go. And then, you know, I remember one of my first meeting and I probably was not a good start of me building great rapport with a lot of people in the room, but I remember this. There was this massive. First, you see these massive meetings where you have way too many people. You would never see that on the commercial side. So many people involved and so much waste of taxpayer money by having so many people in the room. And this was a meeting on adopting Agile. And I remember all these people talking about Agile, but I could tell very quickly that they knew the buzzwords, but they had no clue what they were talking about. They actually had never used Agile in any projects in their entire lives. They were trying to do the right thing, and they're good people, right? But they just don't know any better. And you had all these people talking, and I asked what I thought was a fair question. I didn't create a lot of friends that day, but I said, but who here has even used Agile in an actual project before? Mm-hmm. Right. And so I raised my hand, and I think 1% out of 50 or 60 raised their hands, right?
Yeah.
And they were the group that was supposed to bring the answers as to how to implement Agile mm-hmm. in DoD. That was just mind-boggling to me. I was like, this is a joke. Why am I here? Why am I wasting my time? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, all the stuff you're talking about is common sense, you know, outcomes that we don't even need to think about. We don't need to write a report. Let's just do it, right? We've been doing this for 22 years. I created my company. I was 15. Back in France, I'm 37 now. I was implementing Agile already. And you're telling me we're in 2020. I think it was 2019 or 2018 at the time. And we're still struggling with basic Agile. And I'm here to do DevSecOps. And you don't even know what Agile is, you know.
When you arrived, Nicholas, was that like a punch in the face to actually kind of get under the covers and see what the level of immaturity was in these areas?
Well, I was lucky to have spent 18 months at DHS before. Otherwise, probably my heart would have stopped and you would have to create some type of CPR device to come and save me. But DHS was pretty bad. But this was, I was hoping, you know, we were much better. And so I realized that, you know, people are setting me on this dream of bringing DevSecOps to the department, but we don't have a cloud. We don't have a data fabric. We don't mm-hmm. have basic Agile principles. We don't have any software talent that understand end-to-end, you know, DevSecOps capabilities and DevOps. So there was like, okay, I'm going to have to build all the basic layers to even be able to get there. And that was scary. And at the time, I didn't have kids, so it was upsetting. But I can tell you, over the last 3 years, I ended up having twins, and my daughter is 3 years old now. So I had three kids. So I went from zero to three. And the sense of urgency, and more importantly, the tangible risk of our kids not being able to compete 15, 20 years from now, and potentially an existential threat to our kids, as fully visible to me as this widespread incompetence in the building mm-hmm. of people that are, you know, patriots and they want to do the right thing, and it's not their fault, but the lack of investment in our talent and prioritization and really eagerness to solve the problem was just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, I hear you. And kids changes the perspective dramatically. Frankly, I remember being a professional working before and after kids, and it changes your outlook, and you start to recognize what place, what ideas, what advancements will we leave for those kids. And I hear you. It's horrifying to think if you have somebody like the CCP, like China, that does not share our views for democracy, if you think it through of what it means, it's really scary. It's really concerning. I mean, they're basically a surveillance state now. So that's sort of a frustration I have, that I look out across the US landscape and I don't always see people fully aware. They're on TikTok, but they're not recognizing the ramifications of that.
Most people don't even know that China owns TikTok. So,
yeah. Now, in with all of these challenges, though, you accomplished an incredible amount. Could you tell us a little bit of some of the accomplishments that you're quite proud of in working with teams of being able to move certain groups more towards DevSecOps and Agile? Could you walk us through a few of those?
Yeah, you know, what was very important to me is for me not to forget that I was here to serve the great men and women that are serving our nation, and they were I was serving them, and really I was trying to build capabilities and removing impediments to ensure their success. And I think we demonstrated that a small group of people can actually move the behemoth that is the Department of Defense. And we had great pockets of success. I was hoping to get broader scale to really come to a meaningful point of success. But we were able, for example, to create Platform One, which is the first, you know, DoD Enterprise DevSecOps capability, bringing zero trust and bringing continuous monitoring and behavior AI ML capabilities to life, and an abstraction layer that can help us run software anywhere from the edge to space to jet satellites and bombers and clouds. We democratize access to multiple clouds, hybrid cloud with Cloud One, and make it a commodity. We open source all of the Platform One platforms, so five nations and 12 federal agencies and countless defense industrial base companies are now using Platform One capabilities at scale.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
To enable that reuse and leveraging that scale. You know, we built the first large implementation of Zero Trust in the U.S. government with a cloud native access point, where we replaced the tick and the cap, the cloud access point and the trusted internet, whatever the acronym is, but mm-hmm. The tick. And so we bypassed all these bottlenecks and really brought best of breed, you know, Zero Trust capabilities. So you know, we demonstrated we could put, you know, Kubernetes and service mesh on the U2 jet in 12 days and fly the jet and decouple the airworthiness aircraft software from the AI ML capabilities we brought on the jet, and use AI ML to manipulate the sensors of the jet so the pilot can focus on other better things and receive over the updates while flying the jet with no impediment to the airworthiness of the aircraft, all in 12 days in production, in real, you know, deployments, mm-hmm. all that using also the Platform One capabilities as well. So, you know, we demonstrated that all this was possible and that we could act and move and be like a SpaceX and a Tesla. But what I've failed to see is the Pentagon leadership mandating this as the way to do business.
So as you're doing that and adding all that value, and it strikes me that it's almost through sheer will and intensity and focus, you and team members being able to do that, which I think is awesome. What were the reactions, right? Because I was dumb enough when I was younger, I thought working in government or working in big defense companies, I thought, ooh, if we did this, if we did the innovation, people would just say, oh, this is amazing. Thank you so much, team. I found that was not the case. So I'd love to hear the reaction as you were going along. What were the reactions across Air Force, across DOD to some of these successes you and your teams had?
Well, you know, I think everybody was very excited, particularly during the time where Dr. Roper, you know, was still here, was my boss at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think the momentum changed after he left. Unfortunately, we saw less people care about innovation and DevSecOps and continuous delivery of capabilities. Mm-hmm. There was a massive loss of knowledge as well. And, you know, what was supposed to become mandated never got mandated. And even some of the basic funding of Platform One was starting to get cut. Although my getting public and out and leaving helped a little bit by, mm-hmm. You know, pushing the leadership to fund all this work now for years to come, I'm sure. So that's good to see. But, you know, like I said, what was even more worrisome is when I wrote my exit letter that I posted, I said that, you know, in Pentagon meetings, I always hear the right things. And I've just felt us to see the leaders walk the talk. But mm-hmm. now what's worse is that in the last 2 months, I'm starting to hear the wrong things. And that's scary, because at least for 3 years, I only heard the right things.
What are some of the wrong things? I'm sorry to interrupt. What are some of the wrong things you're hearing?
Yeah. I mean, more recently, a good example is people saying that, you know, we have to move slow and not move too fast. So if we trip and fall down, we can stand back up and continue the fight, where mm-hmm. that defeats all basic knowledge of agility. And the fact is, when you are agile, you move fast, but not in a vacuum, and you do small incremental delivery of value. To mm-hmm. never fall and hurt yourself to the point where you can stand back up. And that shows the lack of understanding of agile by some of the leadership. You mm-hmm. also see, you know, leaders, you know, like the Joint AI Center director say that he's going to push AI capabilities in a slow and incremental fashion, which is, again, mind-boggling, which defeat all principles of agile. And again, we can't even blame those people, right? They are put in a job with no background in innovation tech or AI. And you know, they have zero training on agility and even basic agile understanding. Mm-hmm. So they fail to understand how companies like SpaceX can continuously take risk and move fast and yet deliver tremendous value and yet, you know, be the one that made sure that we don't have to use Russian rockets to send our people to the international space station, mm-hmm. Which was also a disgrace, honestly,
yes.
before they came to save us again. And that's, again, if you listen to a lot of government people at the time, you know, SpaceX had no chance of success. NASA was also even making fun of them, trying to lend back rockets and make reusable rockets. And now it's understood as the only way to do business. It almost sounds like it would be foolish not to do it.
Right, right.
But you know, it's just often too little too late, you know, and people need to start having a broader sense of urgency. And we just need to do better at training. Honestly, the training in the government is seen as a nice to have thing. And it's always the same training. The companies they use to even write the training is all widely mm-hmm. obsolete themselves. So it just compounds the problem.
When we look at some of the things in Platform One in the DevSecOps initiative in Zero Trust, which I am thrilled that you were able to make some progress, are there some case studies or mission scenarios, Nicholas, that really draw out the mission impact, the value of even in pockets of being able to do some of those things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've seen we saved about 100 years of time on plan time. So that's 27 programs. We're going to effectively waste 100 years of time by doing things that we ended up automating. So just that alone is a massive amount of time saved. But again, I argue that we didn't save it, we just didn't waste it, right? So that's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And then Platform One also is the foundation of countless programs now, like GBSD, which is, you know, all the global based strategic deterrence, the replacement of all the nuclear silos on the ground, mm-hmm. Which, you know, is going to be essential to our deterrence moving forward, and is powering all of GBSD capabilities across the entire enterprise.
That's such a fascinating point. So we've got the nuclear silos, we've got Platform One now powering that. What does that mean? What are the improvements compared to the ancient code that we probably, and computer systems that we had in place?
Well, I think it's multifaceted, right? The first piece is we have a development pipeline that shift everything left in terms of testing, automated testing, nuclear surety testing, airworthiness, all the components of better operational testing and cybersecurity baked in, and all that is there day one, and it's a continuous engineering aspect and continuous improvement, and you have all that tech debt building up years after years. You also have the runtime piece where we have the zero trust baked in, behavior detection baked in. So all that runtime is gonna be able to reduce attack surface and be able to detect malicious actors potentially trying to get into the system faster and limit the attack surface and the lateral movement of bad actors inside of the system through what we call moving target defense. We kill, you know, containers every 4 hours so they go back to immutable state. We have also the ability to automate the deployment of the entire stack from scratch with a push button deployment using GitOps and Infrastructure as code. And so everything is push button deployment across classification levels. So you don't have drift between classification levels. So that helps accelerate the deployment and replication of the work and scale the work across fabrics. And really at the end of the day, when you have a very short life cycle and a very short amount of time to build these capabilities, you know, the pressure is on, and these people are already doing terrific job to embrace Agile and DevSecOps and really kind of the first cloud native program starting from the get-go at that kind of scale, and, you know, billions of taxpayer money behind it that will effectively ensure that we end up delivering this program on time and with the right capabilities on top.
And one of the massive things that I heard in all of those benefits is that from a cybersecurity point of view, from a hacking point of view, we've been able to really limit that attack surface basically by using Platform One and these modern practices. And wow, that's even scary just to think about, right?
Yeah, and we you know, we also see this modular capability where we're not stuck in time and we can swap Lego blocks. And if there's something better, you know, this stuff is going to run for 70 years. So you want to be modular and you want to be able to swap things and try different things and over time and not be tightly coupled into a monolithic architecture. And Platform One is designed to do just that as well.
Now, when you talk about, and you mentioned Tesla or SpaceX and their coding practices versus ours in DOD or in Air Force, Army, et cetera, what are the real big differences that people should know, Nicholas? I get that they're modern and we're not, but what does that mean? You mentioned we're stovepipe, they're not. What does that mean? Help us understand that.
Yeah, it's a lot, right? So first, let's use an example, right? SpaceX has 9 platforms and only 200 developers. We have 4,000 developers at F-35 alone. Mm-hmm. They have 80% of the code reused across the 9 platforms. The platform is effectively Lego blocks that can be swapped. So when they have to build a new platform, it just takes moving Lego blocks and trying different things. And very few, very little new work has to be done to create new things. Mm-hmm. So it's very modular and flexible. They do 17,000 builder software a day, 300 in-the-loop testing a day, so they can run the software on the hardware to make sure they're not breaking things and creating risk and regression risk. They can change the software the day before the launch, right? Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we have 4,000 developers. Only 4% of the code is reused with F-22s. It's not modular. It's very monolithic. There's a little bit of modularity, but very small, not good enough. So very much stuck in time. You know, multiple years usually to update software and capabilities, unless it's very small, basic things. Mm-hmm. Very little ability to do hardware loop testing to run the full end-to-end stack. You know, dozens of subs and companies involved, which creates a lot of complexity when it comes to an end-to-end testing of the software. Mm-hmm. And integration of the software. It's not continuous integration. It's not centralized into a central place. Which prevents the ability to do this automated testing and continuous testing. All that is just prime example as to why they're not able to move at the pace of relevance.
So if Tesla, hypothetically, if they made the Joint Strike Fighter and the F-22, then from a Lego building blocks, you could take a sensor out of the F-22, plug it in, you could take a weapon, move it over. All of these different advantages for the pilot and the warfighter that right now you can't do those easy swaps. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, and the Lego blocks concept is foundational. You know, we enable with Platform One about 4,000 Lego blocks to be shared across all DoD services. And you take a sensor on a ship, could be reused on the jet and so on. And mm-hmm. the more modular we can be. And, you know, when you look at how many times we're paying people to do a single sign-on authentication with a CAC, you know, one of these smart cards, you know, that should be just a Lego blocks. And we have it now on Platform One and people can just use that and get a single mm-hmm. sign-on stack from day one and not have to reinvent the wheel every single time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I hear it, I think about from that end user, if you're forward deployed, the ability to have complete access to information, situational awareness, all of those things that modern agile DevSecOps practices can bring versus, again, what that monolithic architecture means. It means I may be stuck on something 20 years old, basically, and very hard to update.
We're effectively stuck on time and we can't try new things and you know, it makes it a very difficult needle to move when you want to try new innovations because you're effectively stuck into this monolithic construct. You know, that's very damaging. And also it's a tremendous waste of taxpayer money, back to my point on, you know, 10 cents on the dollar effectively. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have to reinvent every layer of the stack, and we see, you know, the Army CIO refusing to partner when he started with the Air Force, where we had a 100 million partnership with Cloud One and Army using the Air Force cloud capabilities, and then stop all of that and build his own cloud office from scratch, all to reinvent the wheel with the same exact capabilities, just 20 years behind, just makes mm-hmm. no sense.
Now, as I think about, and in your 3 years as a chief software officer in Air Force and for Space Force, and the amount of things that you accomplished, the question, of course, is why did you decide to leave? And was there a critical moment that really drove that decision?
Hey, it was a lot of different things, but I think there was two main things. One, it was becoming very unhealthy for me because talking about the same problems, and I was almost becoming part of the problem, becoming complacent, getting used mm-hmm. to the velocity or the lack of velocity of the government. So now you have less urgency. You're even like becoming part of the problem. And I was becoming stale as well. Mm-hmm. on the tech side. But then also, you know, I was asked to join also at the joint staff as the first CSO for the JADC2 program, right? The Joint All Domain Command and Control program that's supposed to be this Internet of Things of all weapons connecting everything together, which is a massive cyber risk. So we have to do it right. We have to mm-hmm. have zero trust baked in. And yet we see, you know, Air Force, Navy, and Army doing their own projects in vacuums. And there is no ability to federate zero trust. So that's going to be a drastic impediment to making this more than vaporware. And so I was asked by the J6 to take the lead on this and deliver a minimal viable product in 4 months. And and decided to do the work through some of the Air Force funding. And, you know, 2 months in, I was told, hey, you know, just kidding, we're not going to get the 20 million that we need to build the rest of the MVP. And that was just, you know, that just a pocket change, right, for the department.
Right.
And this was very disappointing. And that's kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. And on top of that, not seeing the right mandates being pushed and, you know, still the enough data to justify it and people saying all the right things. But yet, you know, DevSecOps is still not mandated for new programs even to start, let alone legacy programs to move to DevSecOps, which should be also mandated, but not even mandating it for new programs in 2021 and 22 and 23.
Yeah. And the frustration level, as you said, had to be enormous, and you felt that you were losing perhaps that fresh perspective to really energize and excite teams. But if you could, just because when you talk about the JADC2, had we been able to do that, what would have been the benefit of that, Nicholas? Had we really been able to, in a federated fashion, get them running DevSecOps and Zero Trust architecture?
Yeah, and by the way, one more thing I wanted to say about me leaving, right? I also felt that I would be able to do more from the outside and wear more awareness by being unshackled than saying from within. So I think that was also a good outcome, because by being able to speak up about what's going on, I think we're going to be able to hold people accountable and take better action. So that's
And before I get to my next one, if I may, what's been the reaction, Nicholas, of you resigning?
It depends, right? I think a lot of leaders, particularly on the civilian side, were pretty excited. I got countless people to reach out, both on the military side and civilian side, to thank me privately. Mm-hmm. Of course, most people won't do it publicly, and that's okay. The Secretary of the Air Force was very kind and reached out and wanted to see if I could remain as an advisor to help him, unpaid advisor to help him, and I said yes. And so he's very eager to take action, and he's taking this seriously. Although since the big press and Fox News and all these things happened, I've yet to see any paperwork done. Another funny anecdote is to tell you how bad the IT system is in the government. I was told 2 weeks ago that I've not been able to process my resignation, and so I'm still waiting for the paperwork for my healthcare and all that the stuff, because they can't figure out how to do that. So you want to do AI weapons, but maybe we should fix the human resource systems first. That's a little scary, honestly. It almost feels like I'm the first one to leave the government in history of 4 million people. So
yeah, right.
Pretty scary stuff. You know, I've seen also the military side be a little bit toxic, where what people call the military establishment are saying, you know, I'm creating a personal security risk by going public and saying these kind of things, which I would argue, you know, if that's the state you think and where China stands in terms of intelligence gathering, then you, again, widely underestimating China again. And honestly, I think it's just a good excuse to make sure that people don't go public on things like this, because that way no one is ever held accountable for making mistakes, and they know they might be the next one making the next one, and it's just safer for them not to have these kind of pressure to succeed, and keeping things, as they call it, in the family, which I did for 3 years until it was time to raise awareness, both for the taxpayer and warfighter, and that we had to really take action, and that we were not seeing any type of urgency of or action to justify not doing it. So I think, you know, we've seen a little bit of everything when it comes to the reactions, but I got countless also thousands of people reaching out thanking me about saying what they've been thinking out loud.
I'm thrilled to hear that you're still going to be in touch, hopefully, if we get the paperwork in place, with Secretary Kendall, and that you'll be advising. Now, some of that, I've heard the phrase happy talk, where we know there are really tough problems, but we keep saying, hey, we're doing well, and so forth. Is that a fair way to think about it, as you see people, like you said, not wanting to be really accountable, that we just keep not really addressing the elephant in the room?
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's interesting, because people shouldn't be scared of saying the real facts, because honestly, they were not the problem. This has been going on for 30 years, right? This is not something that's new, where China has been slowly but surely, you know, leading and taking us over now. So I think it's just foolish for people to be like, oh, I don't want to be the one, you know, saying it. And we're going to keep calling them Neo-pre adversary which just compounds the problem, giving, you know, writing more reports, giving us more time to figure things out. And, oh, if we don't wake up by 2027, 2030, 20, whatever,
right,
whoever comes up with these dates, you know, giving more time to continue to fail at doing our jobs and having to wait for Congress to tell us what to do in the NDAA, which honestly should never happen. Leaders should really think of Congress telling them what to do in NDAAs as if they failed as proactively doing their jobs. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have to wait for them to tell us what to do because they're always at least 2 years behind when it comes to telling us what to do. And honestly, if we were proactive, that would just never have to happen.
Right.
And yet I don't see people thinking of that as a failure, as a personal failure at all. And that's concerning as well.
Will you testify before Congress at some point regarding all this?
I've been asking, you know, I've been begging, and I've been asking for both a classified setting and an unclassified setting to make sure that people can be tracking the importance of this. I think it's very important we stop overclassifying. You know, you see China mandating their companies to work with them. We can't even tell our citizens and companies and startups how big of a problem this is because we overclassify mm-hmm. everything. We could easily create some awareness for people to pay attention to this and potentially proactively want to join and partner with us and help us in this fight. And because we keep overclassifying all of this, we're unable to do that. And so we need to do better there. And my hope is that we're going to be able to set some breach very quickly, but I've yet to see action being taken. So that's disappointing.
Yeah, it is. So what I'd like to do, Nicholas, if your game is, let's talk about solutions a little bit, but from the point of view of, you are Nicholas Shalane and you are unencumbered. You have been the Congress and the Senate and President Biden have said, we want Nicholas to do this. He has full budget. He has full authority. And I want to talk through each one of these problems that you've talked about. And if we can just hit the problem real quick, why it matters and what we would do. So the first one I would love to dig into is overclassification. I've seen it in my career all over the place. But in a nutshell, why does it matter so much? And then what should we do to change that?
Well, it matters so much because it prevents us from accessing some of the best talent because many of these people don't have the right classification levels. So it puts us at in a very tough spot where we effectively are stuck in a clearance bubble, and you see it when people trying to hire talent in the government, all they ask you about, pretty much all they care about, is what clearance you got. They don't care right. about your background, what your experience you have or don't have. All mm-hmm. they care about is your clearance. That's sad. I was always shocked seeing that. And so we need to do better there. And to do better, it's pretty simple in a way. We need to have a good data fabric where each section of things and decoupling the who and the what and how and you know, often we overclassify because we don't want, you know, of course, humans at risk. And so we could remove the access as to how we got to know things mm-hmm. and explain the what we got to know and declassify that so people can be tracking the actual risk and we don't care how we got to know it. Mm-hmm. And so there's many ways to decouple that and do better at classification there. And also, you know, the way we share with other nations and NATO, of course, that's going to help as well, right? By having the ability to make more people aware of problems.
Right. And frankly, you mentioned before from a partnering point of view, it inhibits our ability to share with a lot of the big AI companies the key problem sets. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And honestly, they even refuse to work with the government because they fail to realize how bad of a threat it is. They think the bad guy trying to attack China when they're missing all the Chinese actions on the other side and don't have a full picture of what's going on.
Yeah. From your perspective, when we look at Project Maven, what are your thoughts on that related to this issue of not understanding perhaps what China's really up to?
Well, it's a great example, right? I think the fact that Google refused to renew the contract, right? And when I spoke about that, you know, Google came out and said, you know, we have multiple contracts with the U.S. government and we support the DoD. Well, that's not really true. You know, they have contracts with DoD, but that's mostly on the business side. That's not on the weapon mm-hmm. side. And so it's a little bit misleading, right? The fact is we're not here to do business stuff. We're here to build weapons and do it responsibly and effectively and create more safety and better weapons. But we still are here to do weapons. That, you know, the fact that effectively they decided to walk away, I would argue we could have prevented situations like, you know, the bombing of 7 kids, even recently, you know, in Afghanistan, where potentially AI could have helped us proactively detect that, hey, are you sure this is a target? If you know, you have 7 kids in this car, are you tracking that? And are you aware of that? And imagery automation and AI could have helped there. And that's a shame.
You know, it's an interesting thought because a lot of people, they think AI and the overused Skynet, Terminator, and oh, it's going to take over. But when I listen to folks like you, you talk about, yeah, but can it help so much with safety, with quality, with risk? There's a lot of things that AI can just do better. Now, as we talk about, and remember now, you are a benevolent leader here, but you've got full authority. When we come to budget and acquisitions, in a nutshell, what's the problem and how should we fix that?
Yeah, the first step is to cut the silos. So what I would start by doing is merging work. So we need to have joint offices for cloud, for DevSecOps, for Zero Trust. That can just be run out of this or one service. We need to have joint teams. So that means direct report to, I guess, me, if I was in that role, or DevSecDef, right? But very, very direct report. And join teams, merge teams of the best talent from the government, not just one agency being executive agent of the rest. Multiple worlds, never a single prime. The government will be the integration office. Very agile contracting, buying capacity of work with definition of done, meaning instead of buying requirements, your requirements are skills. And then you buy capacity of work, you buy people, but to make sure we're not just buying wasted time, you have to have very clear definition of done, so we know exactly the quality and the delivery into a GFE, government furnished DevSecOps pipeline that's passing the tests, the scans, and the user story checks on the agile side, and the government will be grooming the backlog, and each value stream will be led by a government person, but staff with multiple companies, just like Platform One is, where you don't have a single company running a value stream ever. It's always a mixed set of talent. So effectively, you're buying capacity of work, you're buying people, and you're staffing your cloud office, your platform office, your, you know, your AI ML team, and all this with a capacity. And then, of course, making it easy for companies to bring their tech stack into it, like we did with Platform One and the Container Iron Bank platform, where people can come and get their containers accredited and use across all classification levels using continuous ATO, authority to operate, to accredit the software so it can be used across DoD with no reinventing the wheel and mandate that across all CIOs so they don't have to reassess the software. That would already remove massive impediments and, of course, drastically invest in training, mandating agile, banning EVMs, unvalued management, and all the legacy waterfall practices and moving to decoupling hardware and software, decoupling real-time software with all the AI and ML software, and really doing more agile contracts.
You mentioned with JADC2 and you couldn't get the funding. From your perspective, separate program offices, separate budget line items, is that so much of that discussion we just had that is really inhibiting versus what you said of, hey, can we have a joint office? Can we, you know, have more government interoperability? Is that a key problem, those program offices?
Yeah, first, we don't have enough talent, so we need to stop reinventing the wheel and have Army and Air Force and Navy building things in vacuum, pretending IT is different between the services, which is a massive joke. It is absolutely not true, right? We have different missions, but IT is IT. You need air gap, you need disconnected, you need D-deal, you need all of that. You need edge, you need cloud, you need all of that, right? And the transport layer and the ability to connect, you know, 5G and satellite and fiber and have hot replica, you know, in case something happens and you know, high availability, all these transport layer can be done. And I had a whole plan to do it, by the way, for $12 million with Amazon and Azure involved and all that. And allegedly we couldn't find the money. All that is something that should be done centrally in JADC2. So I would kill ABMS, I would kill Overmatch, I would kill Convergence, which are the Army, Navy, Air Force programs, and merge it into JADC2 and have that centrally staffed and created, you know, having a centralized zero trust team. You cannot federate zero trust and policy enforcement points. So for weapon A to talk to weapon B, if you don't have identity management, right, if you don't have the right access to that data, and the ability to know what weapon is what weapon and are you talking to the right weapon and how do you do that enforcement and do this centrally as an enterprise. And same for cloud contracts, right? Why are we going to have different contracts? We want to have multiple clouds and edge capabilities and best of breed, but it has to be managed by a joint cloud office. And DISA can be part of it, but DISA shouldn't be the only one. It should be a joint team. DISA would be helping with Force Estate, you know, with DoD CIO. You want to have Air Force, Navy, Air Force, top talent, and people that have done it before. And more importantly, I would put in charge, regardless of rank, I would put someone that has done this before, understand the constraints, understand the department, but also understand, you know, with experience, not just with knowledge, but actual tangible experience, how to run these capabilities in production.
Yeah, that experience, of course, is so critical. As you've said, that you can have a very dedicated major or colonel, but if you're not an expert in DevSecOps, that's a real problem. And we don't have that kind of time, as you've also said. Now, in your role as in charge of all of this, Secretary Austin and President Biden invite you into the Oval Office and they say, okay, Nicholas, here's a real problem. How do we rebuild this relationship with the Googles, the Amazons, all of these others? Because there's this ethics challenge, right? Project Maven, a lot of folks within Google said, hey, whoa, we don't want to use AI for weapons. How do we really build that bridge so that China in 3 years is looking at us and saying, oh my goodness, how did they do this? We're behind them.
Yeah, it's public-private partnerships first, right? And small needles and starting somewhere and growing the trust and relationship, but also sharing more data, being able to proactively open up to the threat and sharing some of the activity we see going on so people realize that hey, this is an existential threat to their kids. And look, maybe some companies will be the laggards, and that's okay. We have plenty of companies. I've had countless companies reach out to me and say, hey, you know, we want to get into this fight and help you guys. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm out of the government now, but I'm pointing them to the right directions. And so I think a lot of companies are going to be willing to take action right away. And then, you know, some of the laggards will lag behind, and it's going to be about trying to convince them and show them the light. And maybe through simple first step partnerships, crawl, walk, run, where you're gonna show them some good outcomes, and at some point, you know, hopefully, they're gonna join the fight.
And the reality is, without that partnership, we're not going to be able to get there. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, we don't have a choice. Sadly, the talent we have is not gonna cut it. We're so far behind even on basics of data and cloud and software, that the most advanced AI ML stuff is present in some of the labs, right? We do see MIT and FRL, but it's pockets, and it's not embedded into programs. And most of these guys don't even use DevSecOps. So by the time they try to give it to us for transition and with this valley of death of all this innovation because of lack of agility, effectively, it's a massive lift to move that research into a production use case, which should be baked in from the get-go. So I've been trying to convince DARPA, right, to use DevSecOps and Platform One from the get-go as an enterprise service. But right now, each program has to fund it. So that's a massive barrier to entry. So making all this commodity, right, funding enterprise access to Platform One and Cloud One and not have these barriers, which effectively cost us so much money of bureaucracy just to get access to all this stuff and contract actions and staffing and manning of these acquisition teams. That's just a massive waste of taxpayer money.
Well, you know, in the pandemic, I think it made a lot of people in America aware that, oh my goodness, certain medicines are not produced here. We're reliant on China from a supply chain point of view on all kinds of things. If you would, Nicholas, walk us through. Walk us through what that means when it comes to the world of national security, that we don't even have a chip foundry here. Help us understand the supply chain ramifications and what we need to do from that point of view.
I really believe that the fact that we even let this happen is criminal. You know, I can't believe how locked in we are to China. And on every piece of the supply chain. It's not just IT, but particularly mm-hmm. in IT, you look at drones, you look at chips. Another reason why China is really excited about Taiwan is one of the largest producers of chips as well. So if you lose Taiwan mm-hmm. and China, you're done. Effectively, how do you compete in artificial intelligence if you can't even build the chips, the most advanced chips? You're already mm-hmm. done before you even get to begin the fight. Not to mention the supply chain risk of them being able to embed malicious software. It doesn't have to be malicious hardware. It could just be malicious software, a time bomb that's triggered based on the specific use case where they decide to launch it, which kills the entire software, all the chip itself yep. when it's launched. So there's so much risk. It's mind-boggling to me that we're okay, and I don't see much going on. Just to save a few bucks, which honestly, I don't even know if we couldn't have done as good mm-hmm. on the long run. And honestly, the long-term impact to the nation has been massive.
From a chip foundry point of view, I mean, what does it take? What kind of investment? What sort of expertise? What should we do you think, on that side? Because it's really scary, as I hear from the hardware point of view and the chips, that we're not producing it. So your thoughts on what we need to do right now?
Well, you know, if it has to be the government funding some of this stuff to get the ball started, but the simple fact that we realize that, hey, we're building some new nuclear weapon capabilities and we have a tough time finding chips, and we're in a monolithic situation where we have a single bidder because we can't find a second bidder because we don't have any other options. That's a scary place to be. And so the government maybe needs to start investing and proactively doing that. I would argue it's a very small investment compared to the massive waste of taxpayer I see through silos and egos. Mm-hmm. We don't need more money. We need less waste of taxpayer money. We need people that actually understand and have an understanding of what money is and that don't lose that sense of investment and return on investment. Focus mm-hmm. Because of all these beatings, and it's true that when you see all this money, it tends to become very intangible very quickly when you manage
yes.
beatings. And I understand, but you know, I always thought of it as just my companies when I was an entrepreneur. It's our money. We can't waste it. You know,
absolutely. And you know, one of the arguments that you hear is, "Hey, we're America. We're spending $1 trillion." If you really understand, and nobody's spending that. But what I hear from you, of course, is, "Yeah, but how are you using that money? Are you using it efficiently? And are we using it as efficiently as China and some of our other adversaries?" Couple wind down questions. You have certainly been incredibly forthright, and we appreciate it. And that's brought a variety of feedback, as we discussed. But what's next for you? Because it strikes me that you have an incredible passion to make a difference. So what's next?
Well, you know, the good news is, having sold 12 companies, I have the luxury to doing what's best for the nation and our kids. And I'm going to be spending my time in making sure we raise awareness, and I'm going to hold people accountable. I'm going to be the voice of reason if I have to be. I hate it. I don't like to be on TV and TV shows and stuff like that. But so far, it's been paying off, and until it's making a difference, and until I see progress, I'm going to keep putting pressure. We're coming up with this countdown timer that we're going to put on TV that are going to show people that if we don't wake up by December 2022, we're going to be out of time. So every month, we're going to hold the government accountable to come and show us what progress they've made in a tangible fashion every month. And if the answer is going to be, hey, we're going to move slow and incrementally, people are going to have to find another job, because we're not going to let that happen. And we're going to make sure to put enough pressure for Congress to take action as well.
As you go forward, Nicholas, I'll offer anything you need. Please reach out as far as getting some of these messages out there. We would be glad to help, because it is so important. And I want to emphasize something that you say all the time. This is not meant to be negative. I have a tremendous affection, affinity for friends and colleagues and special forces and CIA, all kinds of people doing God's work. It's about getting them the right capabilities. This is a patriotic conversation, I would offer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, it's just so easy for the Pentagon leaders to forget that they're putting others' lives at risk. And mm-hmm. honestly, I would, that's why we need to hold them accountable. I argue that our lack of advancements in IT over the last 20 years has effectively killed a lot of people that could have been prevented. And, you know, we can't let that happen. And you know, this is the right thing to do. And it's a fight worth fighting. And honestly, for me, it's all about the wolf fighter and empowering them and getting out of the way and making sure that we give them the best of breed and that we're leading the pack and not behind and that we're done saying that people are catching up to us. We should be so far ahead. And, you know, just like Tesla is comfortable open sourcing their patents, they don't care. They're so far ahead. They're moving so fast. They have such a velocity that they're okay giving it away because by the time people even catch up, they're going to be 5 miles away from there. And that's just the way we must be. And we shouldn't even be thinking of these problems. That should be just commodity. And we should be so far further than this. It's a little bit scary that the US government is still talking about basic cloud capabilities when the rest of the world is already moving to much more advanced capabilities.
Yeah, it is. Now, a couple last questions. We've covered a lot of different topics, and I know you've been making the rounds on a lot of different major news media agencies, outlets, etc. What did we miss? What question should we have asked, Nicholas? You're sitting there saying, if he just asked me this, is there something that we missed that you should cover?
Well, I can tell you it's very difficult in shorter interviews of 4 minutes on live TV to get any of this out.
Yes.
And so I appreciate, you know, you taking the time. And I think you actually covered most of the critical points. I'm not tracking something you really missed. My issue is, of course, people are not taking the time to pay attention to this. And, you know, another good interview I just did with the Epic Times was American thought leaders. They did a good job at showing the problem and showing the extent of the issue. And I think you've done the same here. So I'm grateful that we have the chance to do this on larger formats. I think what, you know, people fail to realize, because it's mostly yet too intangible, despite, you know, seeing recent breaches of all pipelines and water supplies and power grid facilities, we just keep dismissing them as not a big deal. Despite the fact that, you know, a nation state targeted a water supply and changed the water composition that could have effectively killed people drinking the water. But because it was small and, you know, one use case, people dismiss it. I don't know what it's going to take, and I hope it's not going to take a massive event for people to wake up. I think it's starting to happen, but it's still anecdotal. We need to really raise more awareness and more eagerness for people to hold people accountable. I would love the help for people to call their congressmen and senators to push for that classified and unclassified brief that I could give to raise more awareness to Congress about the state of cybersecurity and the state of the government waste of taxpayer money in tech and AI and ML and cloud. It's across the government. It's at DHS. You know, we talked about the fact that DHS refused to implement Zero Trust 5 years ago when I proposed it. And kept pushing the perimeter defense, effectively putting all the critical infrastructure and other federal agencies at risk because of lack of leadership. I think that's the kind of stuff that must stop, and we need to hold people accountable.
Totally agree. Last question for you, and certainly appreciate the time and the value added. You've gone up against some enormous organizations, and you've been able to drive change, as you talk about, in pockets. Yet there are these challenges, of course. Yet I don't see any quit in you at all. You want to keep going. You want to keep pushing. What fuels that, Nicholas? What keeps you positive?
Well, you know, we can't give up, right? Because if we give up, that's effectively us saying that our kids have no fighting chance 15 to 20 years from now. And look, I'm not going to let that happen. You know, and anyone getting in my way, you know, they're going to see the full extent of everything I can bring to the table. Because you know, we just can't let it happen. You know, there's no alternative. So we're running out of time. You know, I've been patient. I've been nice. I've been, you know, people were complaining about me pushing maybe too hard when I was in the government, but I knew the risk. I knew the timeliness aspect of this, and I'm not gonna let us run out of time. And if I have to, you know, create more awareness and make people uncomfortable and people not happy that I'm, you know, holding people accountable publicly, so be it. And I'm not here to make friends. You know, I'm here to get this done.
I appreciate your efforts deeply. And like I said, anything we can do to help in getting that message out, we'll be glad to do, because this is truly about the country and frankly, getting the capabilities to our patriots and serve that can provide the national security that oftentimes we forget. We take it for granted because we've had so much here for so long, so much peace and prosperity. Nicholas, tremendous insights. Would love to talk to you again in the future and check in on the battle and the progress that you're making.
Absolutely.
Tough stuff, right? Some of it, I'll be honest, it's heartbreaking to hear. And it's not what we want for the warfighter, for the special forces operator, for that CIA or NSA intelligence officer, for the country. Nicholas is very, very honest. He's very candid. But if you hear him, a lot of his frustration is that this is possible, that we can do this. But it's going to require the full force, the full weight of what we can do as a country. And the tentacles go everywhere, not only in DOD and the programs and how we invest and how we do software development, but in our supply chain, in our education, in our training, in the partnerships from commercial to defense and government agencies. It's doable, but we've got to get at it on all levels. So a call to action. I want everybody, and I humbly ask you as you listen to this, write your congressman, write your senator, share this episode, talk to your family members. We're in a very strange place in this country. A lot of change, a lot of ideas, but this one is a priority, and we need to get the message out. And the last thing I want to say on this is, Nicholas has a perspective that you don't often hear. People are afraid to be as candid and forthright, but that difference, that courage to come forward, is what we need. We need to be able to talk about this honestly, and I've got to tell you, we've got to move. Hit us up on social media. Let us know your thoughts. If you've got ideas of how we can get the message out, we'd be glad to hear them. The intent of Nicholas, the intent of Cliff and myself is to get the message out, to be part of the solution. And as always, keep being different, because that's the only way we're going to solve this problem.
GovCon Different. Ideas from the outside applied to GovCon to drive change.
It's like TED Talks meets the federal space.
Different ideas from different industries, uncovered, unvarnished, and smashed together to produce change in the government space. Join us as we explore a world of GovCon possibilities.
GovCon Different is produced by Market Advocates, LLC, and Nexus ATX, LLC. On behalf of Cliff Sundstrom, our executive producer, and myself, Eric Prostiofsky, your host and executive producer, thank you for listening.